Welcome to the Vanderbilt University Center for Teaching podcast, part of the center's efforts to cultivate dialogue about university teaching and learning among faculty, students, and staff. I'm your host, Rhett McDaniel, educational technologist here at the Center for Teaching. In this episode, we feature a panel discussion with Susan Kevra, senior lecturer in French, Adam List, senior lecturer in chemistry, and Doug Christensen, Vice Provost for Enrollment and Dean of Admissions. The panelists share their experience with first-year students by answering questions like, if we want to help our first-year students move beyond memorization to deeper learning, how should we approach teaching them? What kind of deep learning are first-year students capable of achieving? The panelists share thoughts about these as well as other related questions.
I want to address a couple of these questions that relate to the idea of how you foster deeper learning. I teach a variety of W courses, both in French and in American Studies, and I wanted to start with an anecdote, a true one, actually, that occurred the first time I taught a freshman seminar at Vanderbilt about 5 years ago, and it was a course that I put together really close to the beginning of the semester. It was one of those, we need this freshman seminar, can you do it? It was a freshman seminar called Women of the French-Speaking World, or Great Writers, Great Women Writers of the French-Speaking World. So I thought, well, I can do this. It was a second semester course, and I think there were about 9 or 10 students enrolled who were on my roster the first day, and about 7 or 8 showed up, and over the first 5 days, the population kept changing, and then it changed radically on the last day to add drop. And two of the students who showed up on that last day were Vanderbilt football players, who honestly said, we're here because our advisor said that we need to take this course because it seems like a more meaty course than the one we were going to sign up for. And so here we are. They hadn't studied any French before. One of them had never written a term paper, even in his first semester yet at Vanderbilt, hadn't written anything more than about a 2-page paper. And here we begin the class looking at, one of the first writers we looked at was a 17th century French writer, Marie de l'Incarnation, who is known as the mother of New France, who actually sailed to New France at the age of 40 and established the first convent in North America and did a lot of teaching and working with Amerindians. But I found myself thinking, how am I going to get these guys on board? What do they possibly have in common with someone who lived over 300 years ago, who obviously probably didn't share necessarily their religious beliefs? How do you make meaningful to them the life of someone who spent a good deal of the first part of her life wearing hair shirts and engaging in acts of bodily mortification, who abandoned her son, someone described it that way, in order to sail to the New World and start a convent. So I thought, how am I going to do this? Well, it occurred to me as I was preparing for this class, one of the assigned readings was a letter that she wrote to a benefactor back in France trying to solicit funds. And the letter described what seemed to me like a model for an agency like Save the Children, where she went through methodically and explained the situation in New France, their needs, the need for clothing, the need for shelter, the sorry state of things, but also it described beautiful children there and how much promise that they had, and how if she could take on this commitment to fund a particular this particular building, that it would improve the lives of these children. And she actually names this child, who has never seen the woman back in France, as your godchild. So it's these really interesting strategies that struck me as similar to the ones that you see in campaigns that you get in your mailbox all the day and they're trying to get money from you. So the assignment that I gave that day, before we even talked about Marie de l'Incarnation, was to say, I want you all to imagine some kind of a need that you have. It might be something on campus that you're doing fundraising for. And I want you to spend 10 or 15 minutes generating tactics for how you would get people to contribute to whatever your imagined agency or organization is. And there were some great things that were shared. What it did for me is it showed me that some of the students in the class were really interested in service, community service, and they brought that to the table and used those as models. What these two Vanderbilt football players did was, and I was completely unprepared for this, this was, I think, the several months after, and I'm afraid I can't remember his name, but it was Vanderbilt football player who was killed about 4 or 5 years ago. And so they talked about that experience and said, well, we're putting together this, we're trying to raise money in order to have a scholarship for him. And they talked about it in such honest terms. It was really pretty touching, and you could feel the rest of the classroom just completely engaged with what they were saying. So we used that then as a springboard for going to this letter that was penned 300 years ago to say, okay, let's look at the things that you've suggested here and see how it dovetails with what Larry the Necronesian did. And I think it succeeded in showing them that their lives were not all that far removed from hers. It also, I think, gave them the opportunity to say, okay, I'm here studying this class about French women writers, and that's not particularly that interesting to me, but I just spend 15 minutes talking about fundraising. Maybe this is something that I'll be able to apply in a practical way to my career later on. So it was one of those aha moments that I developed and played with a little bit over the years in other courses that I think worked really well. I want to just answer one other question that came up, and it was the business of exams, and is it going to be on the exam? We all hate hearing that question. I have also, as I've taught freshman seminars over the years in W classes, wrestled with, should I give exams or shouldn't I? And I don't have a definite answer to that question yet. I, at this point in the freshman seminar I'm teaching right now, which is called the French Experience in the Americas, that looks at French colonial history. We start pretty much in the 16th century and go all the way up through a study of Franco communities in the United States, the Francophone presence in North America, including Canada, all the way up to contemporary Quebec. So in that particular class, I've decided that it's worth giving an exam for a couple reasons. One is that I want my students to be able to present a body of information in written form to say, look, I know this stuff and I'm presenting it to you here. Now, I don't give a midterm or a final. I call them hourly exams. I don't schedule the final exam during final period because I think that that can foster resentment when they could be going home earlier, so it happens a couple weeks before the end of the semester. But what it does is they take the exam on the first exam. Generally, most students do pretty well on it. Those who don't have the opportunity to improve on the second exam. It also engenders a discussion after the exam on note-taking, where I'll say on a particular date, okay, I'm going to collect your notes after class. And they'll turn them in, and I'll essentially evaluate them and then come in with what I say is a model of good note-taking to get them to really key into what they're hearing in the lecture. It also ends up being a really good exercise for me because there's nothing like having somebody put their notes in front of you to say you succeeded or failed in communicating your points. So for those reasons, I think exams are good. I also think that exams are a good opportunity for students to do timed writing, and my exams are all essays, and they're quite flexible. Students do textual identifications where I'm asking them to say, okay, this comes from Jacques Cartier, or this comes from Marie de l'Incarnation, to identify it and then explain something about that particular passage. And then there's a long essay question that's also gives them a lot of wiggle room to address things that they're perhaps more familiar with. But it's an opportunity for them to have a timed writing assignment so that I can say to them later on when they come to me and they say, I'm having a really hard time starting my paper. I just can't get started. And I can say, but you did on the exam. I said, go. You started writing and you produced 3 or 4 pages of writing. And they realize that, I guess I can do this. It's a question of procrastination. So for that class, I've maintained the exam format. And another freshman seminar, I've chosen not to for a variety of other reasons, which I don't think I'll go into now. But I would like to think, especially with first-year students, that they come away from these experiences in small group sessions with quirky teachers who teach them how to dance sometimes, or sing them French songs, that what they come away from it more than anything, I think, is a sense that I can actually be face-to-face with this person, almost close enough to touch them in this small group environment as opposed to big lecture halls, and really feel a sense of connection and excitement. And I think that's been my biggest lesson over the last 7 years or so, is how I try to convey my own sense of excitement about my teaching. And I think it was actually in a workshop by the Center for Teaching a number of years ago that someone mentioned the book, and I wanted to say the title while we're here. They mentioned this to me, The Courage to Teach. Maybe some of you have seen this before, by Parker Palmers. And I read that at a point where I really needed to read that book and needed to think about what can I do to reinvigorate my teaching? And I'd already been teaching for about 10 years at that point. And it was really, it's a message about loving what you do and letting your students see that you love what you do, and being, just having a sense of openness with them. I think there's a tendency, I'll say this honestly, I feel like at Vanderbilt I came here and I was fairly guarded as a teacher initially. I came from a small liberal arts college in southern Vermont, Marlborough College, before I came here, which was a school of 300 students where you ate meals with everybody, and I got here and I felt like I had dropped onto an alien planet. And so I felt like I was kind of walking around like this for a while, including my first couple years of teaching. And it was reading, even just read the first chapter of that book, and it'll get you thinking about how it's totally fine. It's a really good thing to just be there and expose yourself and show your enthusiasm for what you're doing. Okay.
All right. Thanks for getting us started, Susan.
Sure.
Adam?
Okay. Well, from a completely different perspective, I teach general chemistry. I typically have 160 to 180 students in my lecture. I have a small lecture. It's at 8 o'clock in the morning. We generally have about 750 to 780 students in the fall semester. So almost half the entering class takes general chemistry. I've been teaching this course since 1999. I guess in terms of looking at the discussion questions, do students think memorizing or regurgitating is what is required? I guess since I've been teaching the course, I think I've always found it definitely a fairly large set of students have that mindset initially, especially after the first exam. We'll get the typical questions that we didn't cover a problem like that in lecture. How are we supposed to know how to do that? Or that wasn't on the homework. How are we supposed to know that kind of information? We definitely use exams for the majority of our assessment, and what we found over the years is that the students are very adept at algorithmic problem solving. Step one, convert your temperature to Kelvin. Step two, figure out what the mass is. And step three, plug those variables into a formula and get the answer out. And students are pretty good at, once they figure that out, they can do it over and over and over again. But often what we'll see is we'll ask also conceptual questions. Do you think this gas would have a higher speed than this other gas? And even though later on in the exam they will calculate the speed of a gas and do it correctly, when we ask them sort of a conceptual question like that, they will whiff and miss it. It's always been a little bit frustrating. It's like the students know how to do the algorithmic stuff, but aren't quite realizing the concepts, are not getting the concepts behind a lot of the formulas that they're using. Let's see here. What does deep learning look like? In our course in general chemistry, we definitely have a series of topics that we have to cover so that our students can build on that in upper level courses. And so what we want students to do is, first of all, fundamentally be able to do a problem, calculate a pH or calculate the speed of a gas. But we would like them to be able to do more advanced problem solving. Take some of the information that we give them in the class and apply it to a problem that they haven't seen before and use these concepts in slightly different ways, or be able to synthesize two different concepts and, again, apply it to a different problem. And a little bit of critical thinking is also what we'd like to see the students. I don't know how many times we've asked questions on exams and say, what is the molar mass of compound blah, blah, blah? And they work through all these problems, and they come up with a number that's nonsensical. Like, the molar mass is less than the mass of the smallest atom. And, you know, you can't have fractions of atoms as a molecule. And yet, you know, a little light didn't turn on and said, wait a minute, this makes no sense whatsoever. One of my colleagues has sort of described it to her students. She says, you know, a C question would be sort of basic mastery of material. So you can calculate a certain value. And a B question would be maybe a little tweak on that. You can calculate this, but there's a little wrinkle. You have to know a little bit extra. And an A question would be to take these concepts and apply it to something you haven't quite seen before. And that's, I guess, what we're hoping to get in our general chemistry class. My experience is that most of our Vanderbilt freshmen are capable of easily doing sort of the B-type work, calculating value, and also learning some of the tweaks and what goes with it. A lot of more of them have a harder jump to the sort of A-level type questions where they synthesize multiple things. Just sort of an interesting aside, you know, based on the students that I've taught over the years, I definitely think they're getting better in our courses. I've noticed that on exams and the types of questions that students ask. When I first started, I would have students come to my office hours, and we would work problems and do problems. Interestingly enough, now, the last few years, when I have office hours, I have students come to my office and ask me, how do I study for the exam? I didn't get the grade I was hoping for. What do I do differently? And that usually is flabbergasting to me, because I know how to do chemistry problems. I don't know as much about, you know, strategies for studying and what might work for some students and other students. In terms of how do I communicate expectations to the students, some of the things I've tried, initially when I first taught, we really didn't have much assessment. The students did homework, but it wasn't collected just because it's such a big class. And so the first exam would happen, and wow, there would be shock out there. And so one of the things I did is I gave a quiz the first day called Things That You Should Know from High School. And that opened a lot of students' eyes to this isn't high school anymore. That, you know, I'm not going to go through the textbook chapter by chapter, sentence by sentence, and present that all to the students, that there are some things that I'm going to expect them to pick up on their own, and I'm going to focus on some things but not others, but I'm still going to hold them responsible for all this. And that was a good wake-up. It got students perked up, as opposed to sort of sleeping through the first portion of the semester and then realizing, oh, geez, I was supposed to have picked up more. And a shout-out to Derek and Clickers. I use, probably the last 3 or 4 years, I've started using clicker questions. Because I think one of the difficult things that students, or the issues that students have is, how do I know that I don't know this material? Mm-hmm. And most general chemistry textbooks or science textbooks don't have as many conceptual questions that ask about the theories behind and what's the implications of those theories. But they're usually solve for this and tell me what the temperature is or what the pH is and that kind of thing. And so I ask clicker questions, and I try to shy away from calculate the value. Instead, I'll ask, again, more of the questions that we typically ask on an exam in sort of true, false, or multiple choice. Which one of these do you expect to be the strongest acid? And just throw out some molecules. And knowing that I haven't actually talked about this yet, and it's not in the book, and get them to start seeing what they know and what they can apply. And I often, if they do very poorly on the question, if, say, less than 60% get what I consider is the right answer, I actually throw it back to the audience and have them discuss amongst themselves and vote again. And usually that works, and that the sort of misperceptions are sorted out from the correct perceptions of the theories. Every now and then, students gravitate to a misperception, but that's also interesting, and it gives me something to lecture on, and I think the students are a little bit more open to hearing that part of the lecture if they just realize they got this wrong, and now we need to figure out why we got it wrong. And probably the last thing I'll mention is something that didn't occur to me early on, is paying careful attention to the homework problems we've assigned. What we found, we switched to an online homework system, so the students had to log in and they would go online and do homework problems. It allowed us to grade student homework, whereas before with our large class, we just gave up. We just said, these are recommended problems, please do them, but we never gave it a score. And of course, if you give something a score, it gives it a little sense of importance to the student. So we had assigned online homework, and the first go around, what we found is the online homework asked the sort of C questions, and it didn't have any of the more complex questions. And so students were very frustrated that I did the homework and it really didn't help me answer this question or that question. And now we spend a lot more time carefully picking our homework system and making sure that we ask some of these challenging problems that we're going to expect them to do on a chemistry exam.
All right. Thanks, Adam. Doug?
You bet. It's quite amazing as I sit here and listen to my two colleagues up here, literally driving to school. My seventh grader yesterday was this exact discussion of, we had a test and it wasn't, we didn't go over that before. I mean, so they're ingrained at an early age to think this way. And to me, it seems like in our education today, society, colleges and universities have a very critical role as we think about cultivation of knowledge and analytical thinking, that we're going to get some products that aren't exactly what we want. But we have a freedom in the academy very different than so many of the high schools in the United States, where it is very rigid and directed of what can and cannot be taught. Their first dose of really exploration to some degree is when they hit your first classroom. Now couple that with the type of student that's looking at Vanderbilt. Highly selective, highly motivated, risk averse, because that's how they've kept their ability at certain levels, and not all, but a high degree. And so then our charge is trying to look at, how do we look through 22,000 applications, that's how many applications we have this year, and say, who's a fit? Who's a fit for Vanderbilt? Who's a fit for that, it's a good fit for that student? And maybe a few facts and figures as we talk about this. Of the 22,000 applicants, we released our decisions last Friday, and we only admitted overall with ED1, ED2, and regular 16.5%. That will put Vanderbilt in the top 15 to 18 most selective schools in the United States. Regular decision, which is the most competitive and by far the largest, it's about 18,000 applicants, the other is early decision, we admitted only at 14.5%. Again, Harvard's looking at an 8% admit rate. So if it gives you a sense of the type of student, of those students that we denied, it is our belief as we look at the academic measures, class rank, test score, rigor of curriculum, etc., and we look at everybody in 08 that we denied, and we look at everybody in 08 that we admitted, and then we see who came back in 09, this year, and we apply those that we denied their statistics, the denied kids to who came back, about 92% of the students we deny could do the work from a statistical algorithm, if you think of it in that sense. So what we're really talking about in highly selective institutions now is the academic bar has already been met by the majority of the students in the traditional measures of class rank, test score, number of APs, IBs, honors, those types of things. So what we're really left with is what we would call the intangibles or directly the questions that are posed here. How do we look at what a teacher recommendation says about a student? How do we look at their essay that looks at insightfulness, intellectual curiosity, the ability to move away from the task, the ability to move away from the sense that I have to know this in a very lockstep manner? But you have to remember, that's how the majority of the students in the United States have been taught. And quite frankly, as we look at our international population, particularly really high growth in from China and India, very rote as well. So we have to look at how are they, who can shine through in this intangible sense. So we're going to look at very directly that essay. And we're going to look at the essay, and here's some things we'll look at. And if I were talking to, if you were all parents of sophomores or juniors and you had me into your high school, which I do all over the country, and for a dean's night or what have you, I would say it is much more important to be authentic in your essay, to be original, to be risk-taking as it relates to your topic that you're choosing, and not look formulaic, not look prescribed, but make us, the admissions committee, believe that you're thinking in those terms. Because sometimes we can write in those terms. So you might say, well, that's very easy. A student can learn the formula of how to write that essay. Well, in a holistic admissions process, what we do here, same as Princeton and Harvard and Yale and Stanford, Duke, Emory, or WashU, those are all of our top 15 competitors now. The only two publics are UVA and Chapel Hill, as far as the public side. And so one might say they're going to learn how to write that essay. Well, now here's what's so important, is you're starting to triangulate what they write with what came in with the letter of recommendation. Because a lot of times you'll get a very insightful essay, but there is no corroboration from anything else that says this student has been one of the best thinkers in our classroom, has moved the class from point A to point B. So you start looking that it looks a little manufactured. We live in a society right now where high-end students and parents will spend upwards of $30,000 a year to hire a private counselor, to package them. And when I say 30,000, I should say on retainer 30,000 from about 10th grade to 12th grade, that package them the whole process. The courses they take, how they write their letters. So we require that at Vanderbilt, two academic letters of recommendation from who taught the course and one from their college counselor. We won't even take anything or from a counselor. We will not take anything from an independent counselor who's received any money in exchange, because we're trying to look at the most independent evaluation. We're also going to look at the types of organizations and clubs they belong to. When I say types, I don't care what they belong to, but what we care is what they did in that. So for example, a student may look at being 20 clubs and, you know, check off a lot of boxes. Does not do anything for the schools I've just talked about. We would almost prefer to see someone that may have been in fewer organizations, but been in them a longer period, and they can talk about how they moved that organization from here to here. It's not about participation, it's about engagement. And both intellectual engagement, social engagement, philosophical, religious, cultural engagement, and trying to look at all of those things as well. And so when we look at our class here, and I'll give you a few quick stats to kind of level set what we're looking at. Overall, like I mentioned, there were just shy of 22,000 applications. 4 years ago, we had 12,700. We've had a 69% increase in applications in 4 years. That is remarkable, but it's remarkable because of what all you do. It is the teaching product, what is happening in the classroom, what is happening in the experiences of the students that are going back. So that's why I'm such a supporter of Center for Teaching, because it's students really at the end. If you don't have that, you don't have anything. We can market all we want, but if you don't have good teachers that push and help people think differently, we as an institution will not progress. So as we look at the kind of some statistics, I said the 22,000, I've gone over the selectivity rate. This year we had a 35% increase over last year's 42% increase over the year before's 24% increase in international applications. That's a sign to see where Vanderbilt's starting to hit on the international sphere. We now the applications are in the thousands, I think there were about 2,000 or right around there international applications, up from, you know, less than like 500. But that's a different student that's going to start, that is really wanting to be here. Our national exposure is we have applicants now from every region of the United States and in considerable number. It's not the South. The South is actually becoming, it's still our largest number. Tennessee is about 14% of our students are from Tennessee, but only about 26% of our student body come from the entire South. That's very different than even 10 years ago. Not better, not worse, but different. So students are coming with very different experiences. Our students of color applications this year were up 35% on top of huge increases the years before. But let me give you a statistic there. About 30 or 29% of our undergraduate student body now are students of color, compared to in 2000, it was about 17%. So that's changed the dynamic as we think about teaching. The international, I didn't tell you those numbers. We've always hovered at the undergrad at about 2%. We're up at about 5% on a strategy trying to move to about 8% as you think about the mix of the exposure the students need. When I look at broadly defined academic measures, the test scores this year, to give you a sense, the middle 50% of everybody offered admission this year for the class coming up next fall was a 31 to a 34 on the ACT. 25% of the population offered admission scored a 35 or a perfect score 36 in the offered class for next year. And 25% scored a 30 or below, and then as you know, it doesn't go much lower than that. The ACT, or the SAT, excuse me, was a 1450 to a 1540 on the critical reading and math. And so again, as you look at that, these are up into that the top end are into the 96th, 7th, and 8th percentile of the student. The average class rank, the student coming into your classes next fall, the average class rank in the admitted class who we've offered admission, now it will drop just a little, but right now hovers at 3.76%. The average student was in the top 3.76% of their graduating high school class. So think of what the type of student that's coming. High academic, high acclaim. What we're seeing, and we're studying a little of our retention, some of the biggest issues that we're facing, because our freshman to sophomore retention rate is 97%, or 96.7, so 97% if you round. That is one of the highest in the country. But when we look at the fraction of who leave, everybody at first makes a general observation about types of groups or athletes or this or that, and everybody has a hypothesis. That number is so small, it's onesie twosies everywhere, and as we dig into it, in some instances, it's the better student of the top students, not they're all really good students, but I mean it's the very top, because it's the first time in their life and they don't have the coping skills to deal with the grade of a D They almost don't know how to react to that. And so we all of a sudden, we become out of their comfort level, but we have to help them walk through that, if that makes sense. So real issues there. When we look at the student body, I think it's important to understand when we go over these questions, when the admissions committee meets and everybody's at a certain level academically, the whole discussion in the admissions committee is exactly what's happening here in different ways of describing that. But it is things like, does the student think learning involves regurgitating and memorizing? Now, obviously, you're not going to ever see a student write that in an application, but you're going to get hints to their type of learning and their type of thinking based on what's in the application. Our hope is we're getting more on that side of the scale as opposed to ones, but I do think we've got a phenomena that is not unique to Vanderbilt, but at all the high-end, highly selective institutions. There is a real concern in the students applying. It translates to your stuff you've talked about in your first class, is they want the prescribed way of how to write their essay, their prescribed way of how to describe their beliefs, because they want, that's what they think I need to hear. And we would by far take somebody who's was a little what they would view left of center of that, but being original, being authentic and getting out there. So that's some of the things that we really struggle with in this. On the other hand, a lot of times I will say you'll hear, well, all the high-end schools are only concerned about their test scores. Well, test scores is an important piece. It normalizes a scale across the national system because we don't have a national system, whether we're for or against standardized testing. But if it becomes your only tool of selection, that is an improper use. We believe when it is merely one of many, and we deny students with perfect SATs and ACTs this year. And people are surprised at that. But that happens now because the test in and of itself cannot get you in. But it does give a normalization to an academic measure in most cases. Not all cases, but in most cases. That's why you don't want to risk with that. We also look at the type of student and the environment they came from. Let me give you another example. Everything being equal, and I always am risky when I give this example, but take an inner city school, and that inner city school, for example, taught two AP courses. And it could be IB or honors or substitute, whatever you want. Take a very affluent public suburban high school or private high school, and they taught 20 AP courses, or honors courses, or IB courses. The student in this course, everything else kind of being equal, you know, I mean, everything as far as their essays were both good and all that, everything being equal with this student that was in a school that had two and they took two, and this student that was offered 20 but took three, everything being equal, one would say you ought to have taken the one with three because they had more. We very well may, and in most cases, probably take the one of two, because you're looking for who exhausts all possibilities in the context they control. Not the context, and we're not advocating someone take 20 AP courses. It's the point, I hope you get what I'm trying to illustrate. It is also, if not, we would have a very, very singular type student body, because economics spread across what is available for students in their context. So we have to look at their context and were they the best, not the context of the best of the whole pool. Does that make sense? We have to look at that, or we just simply would not have a sense of depth and breadth in our student body. Everybody would be Caucasian. In most cases, high portion would be Caucasian, would be from very affluent families, would be from a two-parent household income, would be, or a two-parent family. All the statistics you hear, that's what it would be, but that's not the society we live in. We live in a society that people come from all walks of life, and that's part of that educational piece. So I guess I'd kind of just leave it at that so we can have our discussions or whatever you'd like.
Yeah. Thank you, Doug.
That was Susan Kevra, Adam List, and Doug Christensen. You can view the show notes as well as leave comments or questions about the episode by visiting blogs.vanderbilt.edu/CFTpodcast. If you'd like to share your thoughts on teaching first-year students, we encourage you to stop by our website and join the discussion. Vanderbilt instructors are also welcome to call the Center for Teaching at 322-7290 to arrange a meeting with a CFT teaching consultant to discuss their teaching. Thanks for listening to the Vanderbilt University Center for Teaching podcast. Please join us for future episodes by visiting the podcast's homepage, blogs.vanderbilt.edu/CFTpodcast, or by subscribing to the podcast through iTunes or a similar program. I've been your host, Rhett McDaniel.